Okay, so we can continue with the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort, sammapadana. And so far we have looked at various ways of dealing with the defilements of the mind, and today I want to have a look more directly at the problem of karma chanda and how to deal with that. And many of the things I'm going to look at today are like reflections, way of thinking about karma chanda, thinking about karma in particular here. And please remember when we talk about these things that these are ways of thinking about it, and these are ways of kind of directing your mind in a certain direction, directing it away from the sensual plane, karma vachara is the sensual plane, or karma loka, and directing it to something higher. This is kind of the purpose of this. This is what happens if you start to understand the nature of karma. Your mind moves away from that, and it moves to something higher, something more beautiful, something more happy, something where there's less suffering. And this is the idea behind this. It is not to kind of suppress these things, or to hold them down, or to think that they are bad or evil or anything like that. It's just to kind of direct your mind in a slightly different direction, give you a different aim and a different purpose in life. This is really what this is about. Okay, so this is this next sutta is called the Portalia Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 54, and this is a discussion between the Buddha and a lay man called Portalia, and he thinks that he is an ascetic who has gone forth and does all the right practices for an ascetic, and the Buddha points out to him that he still looks like a householder, and in many ways acts like a householder. And these are the similes, that the large six or seven similes that the Buddha brings out to show the limitations of karma, the problems with karma. Now when I read this, please keep in mind that the word karma has two different meanings in the Pali language. Karma means the desire, the sensuality, the feeling of desire inside, that's karma. But karma, especially karma in the plural, when it's used in the plural, also means the objects of the sensual world, all the things that we desire in the world, that's also karma. It has this twofold meaning, and these similes only really make full sense when you understand both of these meanings of the word karma. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about these things. So he says to Portalia, householder, suppose a dog, overcome by hunger and weakness, was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually, that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Right? So this is sensual pleasures for you. Doesn't sound very interesting, does it, when you see it like that? So it's very, these symbols are very stark, very strong, and they kind of give you a very powerful feeling for how the Buddha regards sensual pleasure. When you look at it from above, when you look down, it looks very different. When you're in the middle of sensual pleasures, you can't see these things. You're kind of blind to these things. But when you have gone beyond and you look down, suddenly these other kinds of similes that start to make sense. Right? That's what we're trying to get to. So you have this dog, right, overcome by hunger and weakness. So hunger here can be considered as a metaphor for craving, right? Craving is like hunger. You're hungry, you want things, you desire things. And weakness, dubalya in Pali, means it's I think here the point here is that when you crave a lot, when you have a lot of desire, your mind gets weak. You lose the strength of the mind. The mind's energy is dissipated, and you often feel tired. One of the reasons you have sloth and torpor and the mind is not bright is precisely because of kamachanda. Kamachanda saps the energy from the mind, diverts the energy. And this is why if you go beyond kamachanda and you enter a state of deep meditation, you get so energized. Energy comes from abandoning kamachanda and unifying the mind, allowing it to rest, not scattering the energy of the mind in thoughts, in craving, in all this movement, all this agitation and restlessness. So you are both weak and hungry, right? And what happens when you're weak and hungry? You wait by the butcher shop. You're waiting for sensual pleasures to come into rain so you can enjoy them. And then what do you get? You get a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton with meatless bones smeared with blood. You get the taste. You get the taste of sensual pleasures. There's a little bit of taste there. But it's not fulfilling. It doesn't fill you up. It doesn't give any satisfaction, right? This is what it's saying here. You get a little bit of taste. It is just enough taste to make sure that the craving continues. So you run off to the next butcher shop, and the same thing happens again, right? And then the next butcher shop, and then the next one, and so on. Life keeps going from shop to shop, from birth to death, and then from another life after that. And we keep on running around, never understanding that we're actually looking for happiness in the wrong place. Every time we get the taste of blood, there's a little bit of happiness there. Maybe the next time I will find satisfaction and fulfillment through sensual pleasures. Not understanding that every time the skeleton is well hacked, there's no meat on that skeleton. And this is a beautiful way of understanding the difference between a deep state of samadhi and the pursuit of sensual pleasures. Sensual pleasures are always like hollow. They never really satisfy. They never really give a sense of fulfillment. And because they don't fill you up, craving re-arises. And you keep on running after it again, and still it doesn't fulfill you. There's always this hole inside of you, right? This emptiness inside of you that doesn't fill up. And so you keep on seeking, keep on running, again and again and again. This is what craving is about. It's like this itch, which you scratch a little bit, and it never actually goes away. You never feel complete, satisfied, and fulfilled. With samadhi, it's the exact opposite. You actually feel fulfilled. You feel complete. When you go into a state of samadhi because of the happiness and the bliss and the stillness and all the factors of samadhi here, you're not lacking in anything anymore. You have the happiness right here, right now. It's not somewhere in the future where the goal of craving lies. It is in the present moment. And for the first time in your life, the deeper the state of samadhi is, the more fulfilled and the more complete you feel as a person. You don't need anything else in the whole world. And you realize that this is what you were looking for all along, when you were running around, craving for things, looking for this object, looking for that object, trying to, every time craving tells you, this time you will be happy. Every time craving is lying, it's not telling you the truth. You get there, it's a tiny bit of satisfaction, right? You get the taste of blood, and then the craving re-arises, and you keep on running, and you're not satisfied, you're not fulfilled. And then one day you turn the mind a different direction, you try to meditate, you get into a very beautiful state of mind, and you realize that you have found that goal, that thing that craving was promising you all along, but never delivered. Now you have found what you're looking for, and you feel complete, you feel whole as a person, that emptiness inside has been filled up once and for all, the hole is gone, and you feel a sense of true satisfaction for the first time. So this is a distinction here. There's a very different type of feeling. The karma, running after the karma chanda and the samadhi are two almost opposite sides of happiness. One is not happiness at all, and the other one is the true kind of happiness. So this is what happens. So don't be like that dog which always runs around, runs after things. I have a dog sleeping on the mat outside my door at night. And last night, all the dogs wanted to have that mat, and they started fighting over this mat. That's the next one. Next one coming. I had to take the mat away, put it away. I felt sorry for the dog, right? I have to finally find a little bit of happiness in life, a little mat he can sleep on. And then it gets taken away from him because they're making too much of a racket outside my door here. So, and this is Kama Chanda. Then the dog came back afterwards, right? And it was looking for its mat, but I had taken it away, and it started whimpering, right? Whoa, where is my mat? That was the meatless skeleton, right, for that dog. Oh, the dukkha. I felt really sorry for that dog, but what can you do sometimes? This is life. Anyway, so that is sensual pleasures for you. So let's move on to the next simile here. Householder. Suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away, and then other vultures, herons, hawks, pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that heron or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus, sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you find your sensual pleasure, right? The piece of meat here is a metaphor for the objects of sensual pleasures. Anything you own that you are attached to, anything you're holding on to, is this piece of meat. So you seize it, right? Seizing here means getting attached to it. So you're attached to this. Because of craving, we go out into the world, and we have upadana. Upadana means we grasp onto things, we take them up, we attach to them. So you seize this piece of meat. And when you seize that piece of meat, other people, other beings also want that piece of meat, right? Finally, you find this nice relationship, you find a nice husband or wife, a nice boyfriend or girlfriend, and other people also want that boyfriend or girlfriend, right? This is what happens. This is the reality of things. So you're always a little bit suspicious, you know, when they don't come back at the right time or whatever. This is how it works. And so this is what attachment does to you. You hold on to these things. Other people want it too. And then suffering arises as a consequence. So what we're seeing here is this fighting over the sensual objects of the world. And that fighting leads eventually to death or deadly suffering. It certainly leads to suffering regardless. And there's so much fighting over these sensual things in the world. There is one of the classic things is when people are to get the inheritance from the parents, and the children fight over the inheritance. And the more wealthy the family is, the greater is the fight. Right? It's madness. The more wealth there is, it should be easy. There's plenty for everyone. But no, the more wealthy you are, the more they fight over the inheritance. Or you go to work and you fight over the promotion, right? Because then you can make more money. The same kind of thing. Or you, and a lot of the things of the world are a fighting, are a lot of the problems in the world, a lot of the conflicts, a lot of the ill will, a lot of the aggression and violence is caused ultimately from the pursuit of sensual pleasures. Right? We want to control the resources in the world. That's why some countries fight to make sure that they kind of get hold of the oil resources of other countries, these kind of things. It comes back to this idea of sensuality, of being able to control things that give rise to people's very shallow form of happiness. And to understand a little bit better why sensuality always leads to violence and always leads to problem, this is also talked about elsewhere in the suttas. And this is taken from the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya 15, translated as the Great Discourse on Causation or Origination. And this gives a little bit of background to how it is that craving always leads to problems. It should be the next sutta in your booklet after this one. It's called DN15. The next one straight after this one. Is it missing? It's missing. Okay. It doesn't matter. I will read it out for you. I've got it here. It's there. It is there. Okay. It is there. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is how it goes. And so, Ananda, feeling conditions craving, right? If you feel, you must crave. We want the good feeling, want to avoid the bad stuff. Craving conditions seeking. You want to satisfy your cravings, so you seek for things. Seeking conditions acquisition. Acquisition conditions decision making. Decision making conditions lustful desire. Lustful desire conditions attachment. Attachment conditions appropriation. The whole sequence is really about once you seek for things because you crave, you get stuff, you heap stuff up, you attach to it, and it becomes mine. You consider it mine. This is what appropriation is about. It's this feeling of this is mine. So because it is yours, it leads to avarice, right? You want more and more. You want to build it up. And avarice conditions the guarding of possessions. Because you become miserly, because you become niggardly, you don't want to share your possessions with others. You guard them and you make sure nobody else can take them. And then if other people also want this possession, that is when the problems arise. And because of the guarding of possessions, there arise the taking up of stick and swords, quarrels, disputes, arguments, strife, abuse, lying, and other bad, unwholesome qualities. So a lot of the problems in the world arise from a craving, from karma, from the desires that we have. I think it's very useful to understand that, because it makes sensuality so much less interesting when you understand that it always ends in these kind of problems. Either it ends in suffering for yourself because you have to give it up, right, the possessions, or it leads to problems with other people in this way. It always tends to head in that direction. Okay, let us move on to the next simile in the Potalya Sutta. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder? If that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body, so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So a blazing grass torch, right? You use that because it gives you a little bit of light. You can see a little bit in the darkness. But then if you take that blazing grass torch and you go against the wind, so going against the wind here might be considered to that you attach to these things, right? That's kind of going against the wind. So when you go against the wind, when you attach to it, it throws the flames back onto you. Pieces of ash, pieces of the straw of the blazing grass torch comes back to you, and it sets perhaps your clothes alight, and it burns you very badly as a consequence. So again, it's this idea, you take up these sensual objects, right? Here it refers to the objects of the world. You attach to them, and as soon as you attach to them, you're setting yourself up for suffering. You will always suffer as a consequence of attachment, because attachment must always mean, in the end, that you will be separated from those objects that you are attached to. So you will burn as a consequence. So then you suffer because of that. I should maybe briefly also comment here on the Buddha says, so too, household, a noble disciple considers thus, right? So a noble disciple is the Arya Savaka in Pali. And of course, the Aryans usually refers to to the disciples who have attained one of the four stages of awakening, right? The Stream Mentor and the Arahat. So this is how the noble disciple considers that, because they understand the nature of these things. They will always think like that. So our job is to approximate our thinking to that of the noble ones, to try to lean in the same direction, so we also can reap the same benefits of the path as the noble disciples have. So just to just mention that, so you understand what is going on here. Okay, so we can move on to the next simile. Householder, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death and deadly suffering because of that. So too, householder and noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures, sensual objects, craving, have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So this is a very, very strong simile about sensual pleasures, being compared to a charcoal pit, right? The coals, there's no flame or smoke, they're just so incredibly hot, just heat remains, nothing else is in there. And, of course, this is one of the great similes for craving, is that it is hot. It's the agga, it's the fire inside of you. And when your craving starts to die down, you feel much more cool, right? It's like a fire inside of you dies down. So, of course, when somebody drags you, imagine you get dragged towards sensual pleasures, right? And then because you understand the danger in sensual pleasures, somebody drags you towards a nice house that you could get, right? And now you don't want this house, so you twist yourself this way and that way to get away from that beautiful house. Somebody has found a nice partner for you in life, a beautiful possible husband or wife, and no, you don't want it. You ride your body or twist your body this way and that to avoid getting into this relationship with this person. That is what it's saying, right? If you understand the problem of sensual pleasures, you are avoiding these sensualities, and you're avoiding it as if it was a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height. Now, this is difficult to understand, and to get some idea of this, why sensuality can be compared to something so painful, there is a beautiful sutta which talks about sensuality in great depth, which I'm not going to read the full sutta, but if you're interested, you can have a look at that sutta, it's quite nice. This is the Margandhya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 75. And I will read out why, how it can possibly be that sensual pleasures, which seem enticing, which seem nice, actually can be compared to a charcoal pit. And this gives you some idea. Of course, you may not understand this fully, but it will give you some inkling of what is going on. So this is the next sutta after the previous one I was reading, and this is Majjhima Nikaya 75. And this is how it goes. So this is the one after the short one I was reading before on feeling and craving. Suppose, Margandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds with his nails, cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Cauterizing means you're burning, quite literally burning your body over this burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a physician to treat him. The physician would make medicine for him, and by means of that medicine, the man would be cured of his leprosy and would become well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. Then two strong men would seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What do you think, Margandhya? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, Master Gotama, why is that? Because that fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. What do you think, Margandhya? Is it only now that that fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching? Or previously too, was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? Master Gotama, that fire is now painful to touch, hot and scorching, and previously too, that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching here. For when that man was a leper, with sores and blisters on his limbs, being devoured by worms, scratching the scabs, after opening of his wounds with his nails, his faculties were impaired. Thus, though the fire was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. So too, Magandhya, in the past, sensual pleasures were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future, sensual pleasures will be painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. But these beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. Thus, those sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch. They acquire a mistaken perception of them as pleasant. So, a very powerful simile, and it shows us why, what the problem is. The problem is that our perception of things are distorted. We are in the middle of sensual pleasures, in the middle of craving, in the middle of all these objects, and we cannot see clearly. We don't see what is going on. The craving itself, the desire itself, distorts our ability to see things. And only by moving out of the sensual pleasures, moving to a state of samadhi, and then looking down, and then seeing them for what they are, is it actually possible for us to understand what these things are. In the meantime, we have to go by a certain amount of faith, a certain amount of confidence. You can start to see this a little bit in your meditation, right? You start to get the niramisa sukha, the spiritual happiness, and you start to understand that there is another happiness which is very beautiful, the happiness of meditation, the happiness of the spiritual path. And you can start to see that craving actually is a serious problem. Because the spiritual happiness is the exact opposite of craving. It's when your mind starts to become still. And thus craving is a problem. You can start to get a feeling from that. But the full understanding can only happen after you attain a state of real samadhi. Right? So this leper, he is literally burning his body. How can you burn your body over an open fire? And the reason is because you have all these sores. You have all these worms and all these things, you know, crawling in your sores. And it's incredibly itchy. It is very, very itchy. If it is very, very itchy, the craving to get rid of the itch is very, very strong. I'm sure you know sometimes if you have a very strong itch, it is very hard to resist scratching yourself because the craving is very, very powerful. And this is what happens with this leper. The craving is so strong that by putting his hand or arm into the fire, or his limbs, whatever it is, into the fire, it reduces the craving. And because it reduces the craving, it feels pleasant. It feels nice simply because the craving is gone. And this is kind of the strange thing about craving, about tanha, about desires. A very large part of the pleasure of the desire is actually getting rid of the desire. Right? This is a very large part of it. The actual happiness from the thing itself, there is a little bit of happiness there, but the very large part of it is just getting rid of the craving itself. So we crave so that we can get rid of craving. That's how it works, right? This is this leper, he's craving, and he puts his arm or whatever it is into something painful so the craving can go. In the same way, when we crave, part of the fun, part of the nice thing about craving, that so that later on we can get rid of that craving. It's like smoking cigarettes, right? I have never really smoked cigarettes. I have tried it a few times, but I was never a regular smoker or anything like that. But basically, why do people smoke cigarettes? Because the craving is so strong, and when you smoke the cigarette, it gets rid of the craving. It's not because it tastes nice, it doesn't taste anything at all, it just actually tastes bad, you're inhaling all the smoke into your lungs. But it's like getting rid of the craving, and then, wow, this cigarette is so nice, right? Why is it nice? Just because the craving disappears. So we can start to see the madness of this craving business. We crave so the craving can go away. That's really all that there is to it. Not all there is to it, that's a very large part of it. So this is what this is saying, and this is the kind of the delusion in the mind, the distortion in the mind. We don't actually understand what is going on. And only later on, when we get cured, and then somebody wants to put you back into that charcoal pit, that's when you understand how painful it actually is. Once you're cured of sensual craving, you go into a state of samadhi, only then can you understand the pain of that craving here. So remember, the problem here is not so much the sensual objects themselves, right? The problem is the craving here. And it actually says in the sutta that if you abandon the craving, if you abandon the kamachanda, that is actually only then are you able to fully appreciate the enjoyment of those sensual pleasures. You can only enjoy the sensual pleasures fully once the craving is gone. It's one of those paradoxes, right? So by craving, we're actually destroying some of the pleasure of sensual pleasures. So it's a weird kind of thing. There's a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya that says when you come out of a jhana state, then these clothes that you're wearing, the simple robes you're wearing as a monastic, the simple food that you're eating, right? It tastes heavenly. It tastes really, really nice. And it is precisely because the craving is gone that you're actually able to appreciate it more. And you understand a higher happiness, so you don't actually crave for them at all. Okay. So back to the Potalya Sutta. That is the simile of the charcoal pit. Very profound and deep simile, but for that reason also it really kind of sticks in your mind when you read that. Next one. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So they are like a dream, right? You dream about lovely parks, lovely groves. When you are young, you think about the future. You think about the lovely wife or husband you're going to get, about the lovely house you're going to live in, about the nice things you're going to enjoy in life, traveling here, doing all these kind of things. You're going to have a nice career and rise to the top of the hierarchy and become a powerful CEO or president of the country. This is what we think when we're young, right? That's what it all sounds like. It's what it all feels like. And we have this imagination and everything. We have this idea about the future, whatever that idea might be. And of course, it is always wrong, right? It is never true. We never see the downside. We never remember the problems with life. We always just see this glorified version of life. We always see is the lovely parks, the lovely groves, the lovely meadows. We don't see the rubbish dumps, the cesspits of life. We don't see that. That's also part of life. It's all there. And if you are honest with yourself and you look back with memory clearly on your life, you will see that it has both sides to it. So remember this, that whenever you dream about something, whenever you have an idea about the future that concerns sensual pleasures, concern what your life is going to be like, it is always a lie. It is never the truth. It is never, ever going to be like that. So this is kind of the big picture, but even in the small picture, if you crave for something, right, you want to buy yourself a new car or something, or you want to get the latest kind of iPad or whatever it is, kind of, you know, that's fairly small. But all of these things, once you get them, they never live up to the hype. The hype, the marketing is more powerful. The reality is actually much more disappointing and much more mundane and boring here. So look at that, see that, and once you start to see it in your own life, you will start to see that this is true. Huh? And to reinforce that a little bit, I will read out another sutta. This is the next one that comes after the Magandhya Sutta. This is the Samiddhi Sutta. And this was a sutta that puzzled me for a while because I didn't really fully understand what is going on, but once you understand it in connection with a dream, it becomes easier to know what is going on with this particular sutta. So, this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, from the Devata Samyutta, and all of these early Sanyutas in the Sanyutta Nikaya are very nice. Lots of nice little suttas there, which can be quite inspiring here. This is one of these. This is Samiddhi. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha, the hot springs park. Then the Venerable Samiddhi, having risen at the first flush of dawn, went to the hot springs to bathe. Having bathed in the hot springs and come back out, he stood in one robe, drying his limbs. I don't know if you have been to Rajagaha. Those of you who have been to Rajagaha, the hot spring park is still there, and people are still bathing in those hot springs. You know, 2,500 years later, you go back to exactly the same place, and you can sort of get this feeling for this monk Samiddhi. You can kind of almost see him. It's quite changed now. It obviously looks very different. Now it's more like a public bath. But in those days, it was probably a much simpler place. It's one of the nice things about going to India, to recognize all the places and the names that you find in the suttas. It's all still there, right? It's like going into history, going into the time of the Buddha. You get this feeling of the presence of the Dhamma when you actually see these things, actually in real life. When you read about them, it's a bit distant, but when you go there, it becomes real. Anyway, so he went there to bathe, and he comes out, drying his limbs. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain devata of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire hot springs, approached the Venerable Samiddhi. Having approached, she stood in the air and addressed the Venerable Samiddhi in verse. Without having enjoyed, you seek alms, Bhikkhu. You don't seek alms after you've enjoyed. First enjoy, Bhikkhu, then seek alms. Don't let the time pass you by. I do not know what the time might be. The time is hidden and cannot be seen. Hence, without enjoying, I seek alms. Don't let the time pass me by. Then that devata alighted on the earth and said to the Venerable Samiddhi, you have gone forth while young, Bhikkhu, a lad with black hair, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, without having dallied with sensual pleasures. Enjoy human sensual pleasures, Bhikkhus. Do not abandon what is directly visible in order to pursue what takes time. I have not abandoned what is directly visible, friend, in order to pursue what takes time. I have abandoned what takes time in order to pursue what is directly visible. For the Blessed One, friend, has stated that sensual pleasures are time-consuming, full of suffering, full of despair, and the danger in them is still greater, while the Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. Right, so is this Deva? The Deva says, well, you have these sensual pleasures, they are right here, right? You are running after something in the future, this Nibbana business, who knows what that is all about? It's far away, you don't even know if you can actually get there, maybe you can't even get to this thing. And here you are, all around you are these sensual pleasures. So she or he, I'm not sure if it's a she or a he, but this is a Deva, and she has a point, right? Isn't that right? What do you think? Who is right here? Is the Deva right or is Samiddhi right? Samiddhi says, oh no, these sensual pleasures are time consuming. Dhamma is right here. So who do you think is right? I asked this, I went to Indonesia a few weeks ago and there was a big audience of people and I asked them this question and people said, oh yeah, the Deva must be right, right? Because That's being very honest, isn't it? It's very honest. That's what it feels like. The sensual pleasures are here. This Dhamma thing, we sit down, oh, can't get anywhere in my meditation. What is going on, right? This is what it's often like. But this is where this understanding of the Dhamma and understanding sensual pleasures as a dream comes in. Sensual pleasures are always about craving. It's always about the future. It's always about what you haven't got yet. And then you get something, and it lasts a short while, and then craving re-arises. It always concerns the future, always concerns something you can't quite grasp. And you can never actually get there. There is no end point in craving. It just goes on and on and on. There is no final fulfillment. And that is the problem. And that is why it is always time consuming. You never get there here. But the Dhamma, the point of the Dhamma here, what this actually means when it says the Dhamma is immediately visible, is that if you practice in the right way right now, if you are able to do an act of kindness and generosity, and you do it with a good heart, straight away you feel an immediate sense of happiness in the present moment. If you sit down and you meditate, and your meditation goes in the right way, and you become peaceful and quiet, and you feel a sense of joy and happiness in that meditation, it is immediate. You have it right here and right now. So if you practice in the right way, if you see the defilement in yourself, and you abandon those defilements, you get the result of that abandoning straight away. This is what it means, that it is immediately visible, directly visible, right? Immediate. It is something that you have straight away. It is available right here, right now. Sensual pleasures are never available right here, right now. They are always about the future. So this is what it means. So even though you haven't got Nibbana straight away, even though you haven't got the highest kind of stages of the path, you have something, and that is always available if you practice in the right way. So that is that little beautiful little thing with Samiddhi and the Deva, and it kind of makes it clear what is gives a bit of clarity as to what is going on here with sensual pleasures. So we come to the next simile. This is a simile of the borrowed goods, and this is the one I read out to you yesterday, so I'll just go through this very quickly. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage, fine jeweled earrings, and preceded and surrounded by those goods, he went to the marketplace. Then people seeing him would say, "Sirs, that is a rich man. That is how the rich enjoy their wealth." Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here, sensual pleasures means all the objects, all the relationships, everything that we attach to in this world, right? Everything we own, everything we attach to will have to be given back. Often it has to be given back right now in this life at some stage, but at the latest, it will have to be given back when we die. Everything will have to be let go of. Everything we have, everything we own, even our status and all these other kind of things that we build up in this life. So remember that, right? And again, what that means, of course, is that we focus on different things. We focus on things that we can take with us into the future. We focus on those things that are not really borrowed in the same way. And that is the spiritual qualities that we build up in our heart and in our mind. That is what we can take with us into the future after we pass away. So even those things eventually are borrowed, but they are less borrowed than the borrowed things in this life. Even those things eventually pass away, but they last a much longer time, the spiritual faculties. And of course, if we go all the way to Nibbana, take it all the way to the end, then all borrowing stops at that point. The end of borrowing, that's another name for Nibbana. That's interesting. Okay. Let us come to the very last simile, and this is also quite a rich simile, this last one. Householder, suppose there were a dense grove, not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and he entered the grove, and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. Then the second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and taking a sharp axe, he too entered the grove and saw that tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, "This tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag." And he did so. What do you think, householder? If that first man who had climbed the tree doesn't come down quickly, when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body, so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to the fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So here you have this idea of a dense grove, right? A dense grove can be considered like the human realm, or not the human realm, but the Kama Vachara, the Kama Loka, the realm of sensual pleasures. This is the realm of the sensual pleasures that we're in now. There's just everything we do, we're always moving around, we're seeing things, we're hearing things, always being attacked, so to speak, by the objects of the senses. So we are immersed in this grove, right? We can't see beyond this. This is everything we know. The five senses always being operational, always encroaching on us, and we can't know anything beyond that. So this is like the grove of life, and while we are in this grove, in this Kama Loka, we are wandering around, right, searching for sensual pleasures, and then we find this tree, which is laden with sensual pleasures. So a lot of wandering around, always walking around searching for these things, and then we have to work for our happiness, right? Either we have to climb the tree, or we have to cut it down at its root. It always involves work, the acquiring of sensual objects and sensual pleasures. We have to keep running after partners, trying to entice them one way or another. Or we have to work hard to make money so we can get all the sensual pleasures that we want. It always involves hard work to get these things. So this is part of the simile. And then eventually, after all that hard work, while you are immersed in the sensual world, and that is all you know, you cannot see beyond it, because the grove is so dense, you cannot see anything outside, then you get up into the tree, and finally, you get hold of those sensual pleasures, right? These beautiful mangoes high up in the tree, and then you just hang out there, and you enjoy, you indulge, you get intoxicated, right? Intoxicated with the taste of the beautiful mangoes in that tree. And this is what happens when we indulge in sensual pleasures. That is a type of intoxication. You forget what is dangerous. You forget that life is short. You forget that you have to conduct yourself well by body, speech, and mind. And you start doing all kind of crazy things. And when a danger approaches, the danger being the man with the axe who wants to cut down the tree at the root, when a danger approaches, you are so completely involved with the enjoyment of sensual pleasures, you're so intoxicated, you cannot see that a danger has arrived. And because you cannot see that the danger has arrived, the tree falls over, and as a consequence, you incur lots of problems. You get reborn in the bad realm because you have been misconducting yourself as a consequence of the intoxication with sensual pleasures. So this is what happens. And you think that you're going to enjoy yourself, but actually, in the long run, all you get is suffering because you're not careful, because you become heedless. You lose your care in the world, and you start doing stupid things as a consequence. Now, the opposite of walking around in the jungle and walking around in this dense grove, the opposite is to you find a little mountain, right? There's a little mountain of rock in the middle of this jungle. And then you climb this rocky mountain, and you get to the top of this rocky mountain. And when you get to the top of the Rocky Mountain, you look down, and now you can see that you were immersed in the jungle before. You couldn't see around you. You didn't understand where you were. You didn't understand where you were going. You weren't going anywhere at all. Just wandering around and around among these sensual pleasures. And now for the first time you are above, and you can see the suffering that you were immersed in before. And there's a simile of this found also elsewhere in the suttas. That's in the Dantabhumi Sutta, I think, Majjhima Nikaya 125, which talks about exactly the same thing. And it's also the story that Ajahn Brahm tells in Ajahn Brahm's story, Opening of the Door of Your Heart. I think that story, perhaps it comes originally from this particular sutta, I'm not sure. But there Ajahn Brahm tells the story, maybe a bit more fleshed out than in the sutta, of him traveling in the jungle in Guatemala. And one day, after traveling in this very dense jungle, having no idea where he was, what he was doing, he got to the pyramids. He climbed the pyramid, and when he climbed the pyramid, he got above the canopy, above the trees, and for the first time, he could see what was going on. He could understand all the tracks in the jungle, all the rivers, he could understand what actually was happening down there, which he wasn't able to see before. And this is a simile for samadhi. Simile for samadhi, you rise above the realm of sensual pleasures. And when you rise above it, for the first time, can you actually understand that before you were trapped in this forest, and you couldn't see clearly, and you didn't know what was going on, and you lacked perspective on life. Samadhi makes you go above this, and you can understand for the first time. So that is the last simile there in this beautiful Potalya Sutta. So again, I recommend you just to reflect on these similes, see what it does to you, see if it has an effect, and if you reflect on these things in the right way, the purpose is to move you a little bit in the right direction, right? So when you meditate, you go a little bit more deeply, because you are a little bit less attached to the objects of the world, and you have a little bit less desire for the worldly things, the kama gunas, as it's called in the Pali. That is really all, this is really the purpose of that. The purpose is not to kind of create some artificial disgust inside of you about sensual pleasures. The idea is just to guide your mind very gently in the right direction. Okay, I will do one last quick sutta before we end for this morning. This is the last sutta on sensual pleasures, so it's quite handy to have a look at that now. And this is a sutta, I remember reading that a few years ago, and it struck me as a very interesting sutta. And again, it's about helping us to abandon sensuality. So I will read through it, and I will comment very briefly on it afterwards. Bhikkhus, I will teach you a Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement. Listen to that. And what is the Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement? A woman, Bhikkhus, attends internally to her feminine faculty, her feminine comportment, her feminine appearance, her feminine aspect, her feminine desire, her feminine voice, her feminine ornamentation. She becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, she attends externally to a man's masculine faculty, his masculine comportment, his masculine appearance, his masculine aspect, his masculine desire, his masculine voice, his masculine ornamentation. She becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, she desires union externally, and she also desires the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are delighted with their femininity enter upon union with men. It is in this way that a woman does not transcend her femininity. A man, Bhikkhus, attends internally to his masculine faculty, his masculine comportment, his masculine appearance, his masculine aspects, his masculine desire, his masculine voice, his masculine ornamentation. He becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, he attends externally to a woman's feminine faculty, her feminine comportment, her feminine appearance, her feminine aspect, her feminine desire, her feminine voice, her feminine ornamentation. He becomes excited by these. He takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, he desires union externally. And he also desires the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are delighted with their masculinity enter upon union with women. It is in this way that a man does not transcend his masculinity. This is how union comes about. Right? So, the desire, the sensual desire that you have for the opposite gender, it is rooted in how you regard yourself, how you look upon yourself. And if you delight in your own gender, if you identify with your own gender, right, I am a man, I am a woman, you identify with that, and you delight in that, and you look at yourself in the mirror and you kind of delight at what you see, gender-wise, then of course, that is actually where the problem arises. So a lot of sensuality can be alleviated and can stop if we stop thinking of ourselves so much in terms of genders. If you just think of yourself as a human being, neither a man or a woman, and don't really think in terms of genders, you actually tend to go beyond the attraction and beyond the karma that is involved in this sort of thing, the sexuality, if you like. So very, very powerful. It is how we look at ourselves that really matters the most. And of course, this is what, when we look at the asubha bhavana, right? The asubha bhavana, the asubha kamatana, it is often talked looking at the 31 parts of the body. Then when we do that, we should always look at ourselves. This is where it comes from. Start with ourselves, because it is the attraction to ourselves that is the main problem and the starting problem for this whole thing. So look at ourselves first of all. Diminish our attachment to our own gender and our own body. That is where it begins. And one of the things that I have noticed in life, that those people that I meet often who are the most proficient in meditation, who have gone the furthest on the spiritual path, they become almost like gender neutral. It's almost as you don't really think of them as men and women anymore. It's almost they have gone beyond that aspect of being a man and a woman. Physically, they are still men and women, but they don't act as if they are men and women. It's like psychologically, they have gone beyond that. Somebody who is a very deep meditator, when they come out of meditation, there is a sense of kind of neutrality about them, which is very strange. Not strange, it's actually very freeing, right? And you actually relate to them as human beings rather than relate to them on the basis of gender. And of course that is what you would expect, because the deep meditations, the Brahma Loka, the highest stages of meditation, they are genderless states. You go beyond gender. The Brahma realm, when you are a Brahma, there are no male and female anymore. Everybody is the same. You have gone beyond gender. This is one of the aspects. As you go through the meditations, you go through samsara, you reach the point where gender becomes irrelevant, and you have gone beyond that. So you would expect the same thing to happen to somebody who meditates very deeply. They would also have gone beyond gender to a certain amount. And it's interesting, because you see people like that, and I'm sure you have felt that yourself sometimes, when you see somebody who's gone a long way on this path, they lose that gender identity to a very large extent. So this means that try not to identify too much with your gender, and if you reduce that gender identity, you will also, this defilement will decline. And then we have the opposite case, and that should be fairly obvious now how that goes. And how does disengagement come about? A woman, bhikkhus, does not attend internally to her feminine faculty, to her feminine comportment, her feminine appearance, her feminine aspect, her feminine desire, her feminine voice, her feminine ornamentation. She does not become excited by these and take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them, she does not attend externally to a man's masculine faculty, masculine comportment, masculine appearance, aspect, masculine desires, masculine voice, and his masculine ornamentation. She does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them, she does not desire union externally, nor does she desire the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are not delighted by their own femininity become disengaged from men. It is in this way that the woman transcends her femininity. You go to a higher plane, you go to a greater happiness, you go to the Brahmaloka as a consequence. A man, because does not attend internally to his masculine faculties, etc., his masculine ornamentation. He does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them, he does not attend externally to a woman's faculty, feminine faculty, etc., her feminine ornamentation. He does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them, he does not desire union externally, nor does he desire the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are not delighted by their own masculinity become disengaged from women. It is in this way that a man transcends his masculinity. This is how disengagement comes about. This, because, is the Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement. Okay, so that is all for this morning. We'll see you again this afternoon.